Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Pamela Muhammad, and I would like to welcome you to our show, A Time for Justice. This show is hosted by the Elevated Places Network, and we would again like to thank you for tuning in. As I said, my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad. I've been practicing law for over 30 years. And I will be your host. Throughout my 30 years of practice, I've seen many unjust laws, such as the school-to-prison pipeline, the juvenile incarceration, the destruction of families, the aftermath of crack cocaine sentencing our brothers and sisters in our neighborhoods. And so we're very excited to introduce this new show, because this show, we talk and discuss legal and current events in a roundtable format. We really like to focus on how this country and the centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws have really had a negative impact on the Black nation, the overall failure of the legal system to give justice to us. And so tonight, our show is entitled The Wicked Use of the Law by the Legal System. That's right, The Wicked Use of the Law by the Legal System. So what I would like to encourage you all, thank you for calling, and if you have a question or a comment, please press the button, press the number one to get into the host queue, and you will be invited to ask your questions as you listen to this exciting show that we have planned for you all tonight. So we're going to talk about, again, the wicked use of the law by the legal system, and right on point, there's a case that was decided in Houston, Texas, regarding the vaccines. This case was a lawsuit that was originally filed by some plaintiffs. I believe there was 117 employees who filed this lawsuit against a Methodist hospital, a hospital here in Houston. And unfortunately, the lawsuit was dismissed. And we're going to talk about that, because a lot of times when you see the headlines and you think of, oh, this is dismissed, the judge has issued an opinion, people don't understand that that's not a final decision. That case can be appealed. And a lot of times also we think of these opinions as being a definitive answer on the question of whether or not the plaintiffs had a just cause when they filed the lawsuit. And I'm here to tell you that is not necessarily the case, and I definitely don't think it's the case in the matter of the Methodist Hospital lawsuit where the plaintiffs filed this lawsuit. as you all will remember, and you may be familiar, but last week we went into depth talking about the lawsuit because one of our sisters, Charlene Muhammad, she actually wrote a case in the Final Call, as well as we spoke about the case that was the front page coverage, which was written by our sister, Dr. Ava Muhammad, who I want to say is the person who Elevated Places Network really, in my mind, represents, because her show is the host show, the Ask Dr. Ava show. But going back to her writing of this article about a call to action, where we actually discussed the legal, different actions that are being filed all over this country about the unlawful vaccinations and the attempts to vaccinate our people. So as I was saying, the plaintiff in this case, their main arguments were that they felt like forcing something into your body that you're not comfortable with in order to keep a job seemed like that was illegal. That's how they felt. The plaintiff is quoted, and this is my favorite quote. She said, you know what, I'd rather be 80 to 90 years old on my deathbed knowing I did the right thing rather than doing something for money or to keep a job. She said that's not what's important. So these people, they stood up against their employers' attempt to mandate them to either keep a job and take this vaccine or lose their jobs. And so, again, that case, we're going to discuss it because on 6/11, there was an order that was issued. It was sometime this weekend, and we're going to go into detail where the judge actually issued an order dismissing the case. But again, we're also going to talk about in understanding what the wise use of law by the legal system really kind of goes to is when we talk about the issue of discretion. Now, judges have so much discretion. And discretion, that's really saying that you have the ability to make a decision that is based upon your interpretation. That's saying, really, discretion under the law is only governed by whether or not the people's judgment or conscience, the power of officials to act according to the dictates of their own judgment and their own conscience. So we know that judges, prosecutors, mayors, different elected officials who have discretion to act. And we see that discretion hasn't always been in our favor, just like legal opinions where people give their own opinions, their own reasons, their own beliefs haven't always been in our favor. Real quick, I want to mention, if we remember legal historical opinions such as in the 1619 casual, where they decided that it was actually lawful to kill a black person if they were determined to be your quote-unquote property in slavery. And so that was a legal opinion, and we know that that was not just. That was, definitely not just. We know that there was another act, the act of, I think that is going to be 12, in 1662, where this act showed that black babies were the property of the mother, belonged to the mother, because this enabled them to be kept slaves, even in instances where these children had been the product of rape by white men. But they passed a law to say, no, you're not going to exempt these children from slavery just because their fathers are white. They're still going to be slaves. And so we know these are laws. These are unjust laws. So we have plenty of history of the unjust laws. And I know we can talk about Dred Scott because that is one of the major laws that we know where a black man's rights were not even considered as being that of a citizen, and no white man had to respect those rights. So we're going to get into that. But I want to go ahead and open up. This is a panel, and we have some wonderful, wonderful guests on our panel tonight. I am so excited. We have Sister Attorney Barbara Muhammad. We have Brother Attorney Abdul Arif Muhammad, who is the General Counsel of the Nation of Islam, and we have Attorney Athil Muhammad, who is a discrimination civil rights defense, and he puts that he's a defender against criminal accusations. So these are the type of thought-provoking and enlightening attorneys and people that we have to speak with you tonight. So without further ado, I would like to bring up Sister Attorney Barbara Muhammad, who she says she's a general practitioner, which means that she can do a lot. And Sister Barbara is licensed to practice law in all of the courts of the state of New York, also in Washington, D.C., and in the United States Supreme Court. Her areas of practice are criminal law, real estate, family, corporate, bankruptcy, domestic relations. Sister Barbara's prior experience is she lists some of the things, and she has, this beautiful sister is such a wealth of knowledge, and she has been a part of the nation and the, you know, the team of attorneys that have fought for the cause of righteousness and justice for a very long time. So her experience she lists is that she's New York City Department of Employment, Deputy Inspector in the 80s. She's Office of the Queens District Attorney also in the 80s, and Muhammad Mosque number 7 in the 80s until 2007. So she says that her currently, she is in the general practice of law. So that is Sister Attorney Barbara Muhammad. And I'm going to bring in Sister Barbara. Also, I would like to go ahead and open the mic for Brother Abdul Arif. And Brother Abdul Arif Muhammad is the General Counsel for the Nation of Islam. Our brother, Attorney Arif, is from the city of Baltimore, where he attended the public schools in Baltimore. He actually talks about how he won a first prize delivering a speech at the age of 11, a speech on Dr. Martin Luther King. He also went to college, and actually it was in his senior year that he met the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan in 1979 at Chopin State College in Baltimore and accepted to become his helper and follower that same day. And Brother Arif actually attended, he graduated from the University of Maryland in the 70s. And I know that Brother Arif graduated from Howard University Law School, where he was also elected in his final year as the student bar president of his class. In addition, Brother Arif was appointed in 1993 by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan as the Mid-Atlantic Regional Minister, and he was headquartered in D.C., at Mosque Number 4. He served in that capacity until 1997. He was the regional director of the Million Man March and served on the national board. Brother Arif, actually, in 1999, relocated to Chicago. And also, Brother Arif was appointed in 2012 by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan as a member of the Executive Council of the Nation of Islam. And he is also a member of the research team serving the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Brother Arif continues to be a helper, follower, and student in the ministry of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, and he continues to give us revelation and a deeper understanding of the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So I would like to bring on Brother Arif and welcome you. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Pamela and Sister Barbara and Brother Thiel and all who are listening. And thank you so much, Sister Pamela, for this wonderful opportunity. And it's a source of great honor to be on the show with you. And congratulations again.
Oh, yes, sir. It is my honor and privilege. All praises due to Allah for you joining us. And thank you so much for attending. It is my honor and privilege for you to be on the show, Brother Arif. And I would like at this time to introduce Brother Athil Muhammad. And Brother Athil is going to be, he's also one of our panelists. Brother Athil is a wonderful attorney here in Houston, Texas. He actually was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science in 1985, attending Lincoln University. And he likes to refer to Lincoln as the premier historically black college in Chester County, Pennsylvania. And I think that's very important to note because we love our HBCUs, and we know these HBCUs are so responsible for many of the brilliant minds and black attorneys that we see, as well as the other schools. We love all of our schools and universities that help black people get in it out in this legal profession, that they can help our people. So going back to Brother Athil's bio, Brother Athil likes to talk about his West Indian heritage. This is one of the things he says he's driven by. And so he came to Houston, Texas, where he earned proudly a Juris Doctorate degree from Texas Southern University. Brother Athil, he practices in employment, federal employment discrimination, civil rights matters. He represents people accused of crimes in federal and state courts, as well as representing people in proceedings and hearings with various federal and state administrative agencies. Brother Thiel is licensed in the Southern District of Texas and the United States Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit down here in Houston. Mr. Muhammad also, Brother Thiel, serves as an attorney staff assistant to the General Counsel of the Nation of Islam, and he is a member of the NAACP Houston Community Legal Redress Committee. He also is a proud member of Omega Psi Phi fraternity. I'm going to put that out there. And so we'll talk more about these brothers and how you can reach them when you would like to talk to them. And so I want to make sure that I do have Sister Attorney Barbara Muhammad's line open and make sure that she's pressing one. If she is on the line at this time, our sister, make sure you press the number one to get into the host queue. And so I wanted to go, you are? Okay, Sister Barbara, thank you so much. Sister Barbara, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Yes,
so,
ma'am.
Thank you. I'm going to press one now.
Well, you're in now. So I'm
okay.
A helper, and the sister who is serving as the executive producer for us tonight, she so efficiently brought you on, and I'm so thankful. This is my daughter, Sister Nyla, so I do thank you so much. And so
yes.
I want to make sure, Brother Arif, your line is open, and Brother Athil, is your line open?
Hear you if you can hear me. I can hear you.
Okay, yes. All right, great. And so as we talked about this discretion, which oftentimes in legal opinions has not been helpful to blacks, has not ruled to uphold our rights, and actually has been used to oppress us many times, and oftentimes the poor as well. And so in our topic, the wicked use of the law by the legal system, we really wanted to start with you, Brother Arif, and ask you, you're aware of the lawsuit in the Houston Methodist case where the plaintiffs sued because they did not want to take any vaccine in order to supposedly keep a job. They didn't want to subject themselves to that. So I want to ask you, what are your thoughts about this opinion that seemingly dismisses the case, Brother R?
Well, and as much as our topic, first of all, assalamu alaikum. In the
Why
name of Allah, the Beneficent and Merciful, I bear witness there is no God but Allah. I bear witness Muhammad is his messenger. We thank him for his intervention in our affairs in the person of Master Fahd Muhammad, We forever thank him for raising among us his Christ, the Mahdi, the most honorable Elijah Muhammad, and we thank Allah so, so much for the man that the two hands, their two hands made, who is among us today. We should begin to see him if we have not already, but we see him and know him as the Messiah. And if you read the scriptures of Jesus and his works, I think you see a very excellent parallel there in the honorable minister Louis Farrakhan as that Jesus. So, having said that, I greet you again in peace. Assalamu alaikum. Now, since our topic is the wicked use of law, the first thing that came to my mind when I saw the decision was the scripture, they frame mischief by means of law. Anyone who has a fair understanding of the issues surrounding the emergency use authorization, not approval, the emergency use authorization and the law that governs this emergency use authorization and its conditions and its prescriptions and its requirements would have to ask one what was on the judge's mind other than being a part of the effort to herd people to take a vaccine that, as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said, is death itself. And we know it not to be a vaccine. We know it to be gene therapy because it's not actually a vaccine, nor is it created in the way vaccines are created. So for the judge to disregard the emergency use authorization law that's in the U.S. Code and ignore its prescriptions that everyone has the right to not only be fully informed about the impact of deciding to take such, and also their absolute right to exercise their option to not take it, and for him to disregard it and to actually even say that his focus was not on whether or not it's experimental or not, and his focus is not on the law. In other words, he wasn't concerned about that. He was determined to make a decision that people are falsely saying mandates constitutionally that you have to take the vaccine. And this is the wickedness of the media and of the law, because now people are wickedly interpreting that limited decision to suggest now in the media that somehow the judge has ruled that it was constitutional for the quote-unquote employer to mandate you take the vaccine. That decision stood for no such proposition, and people should not be deceived in what they're hearing, but this is the wickedness that we're facing in terms of the wicked use of the law. So that's my opening statement concerning that.
Yes, sir, that's really beautiful. Thank you, Brother Arif, because as you say, the opinion it squarely says that vaccine safety and efficacy are not considered in adjudicating these issues. And there was even in his dismissal order, he denied even listening or taking into any account the expert opinion of someone who could talk on that issue. I believe this man's name was Peter McCullough. And so, you know, this is very good showing how the wicked use of the law and the misinterpretation. And so anyone else, I wanted to ask Brother Athiel, did you have a comment or opinion on this opinion regarding the Houston Methodist case?
Well, and I thank you for, you know, having me as a panelist this evening. I'm very honored to be panels, and I hope what we have to say to our listeners that some people understand what it is that we're saying. And first and foremost, I want to greet everyone the nation's greetings of peace and paradise of assalamu alaikum. Thank you all for having me. You know, it goes to Pamela as to what you were saying initially, the discretion. You know, there when you take when a judge has discretion to decide a case, you know, in my opinion, and of course we can never get away from individuals' personal feelings. And so,
right.
You know, your personal feelings and experiences all too often dictate, you know, what it is that, you know, how it is, rather, not what it is, but how it is that you are going to rule in such a way. Now, you know, so if somebody is already predisposed or has an inkling, you know, to do one thing, well, then he or she is certainly going to use, you know, his own experiences, his inklings, to look at a way in writing an opinion or and decision. And that's where the, you know, discretion comes in. And that's what I really think happened there, that, you know, that it was, you know, a personal opinion and, you know, utilizing the his rule of discretion that, you know, in my opinion, you know, assisted him in making this decision and this ruling. You know, and what I also find curious is, as you know, for a few colleagues and I discussed this earlier today and yesterday, was that, you know, how quickly the ruling came. You know, if any of us, you know, well, I know, you know, our panelists, of course, have, you know, practice in the federal arena, but just, you know, just as lay people, you know, oftentimes cases take a while before they get to this stage. And for it to, you know, have moved so quickly, you know, that, you know, there was something there that needs a little bit more scrutiny, or should cry a little bit more scrutiny, in how we were able to get a ruling, an order of dismissal so quickly, you know, in this thing. You know, we've dealt with so many cases on the federal level, and it takes a while even before you get your first hearing. Now, you know, I don't know all of the, you know, machinations that were in place, so, you know, perhaps, you know, others who, you know, studied the case and the proceedings a little bit more thoroughly than I have, but I'd be curious to know how this matter got to this stage so quickly. Oftentimes, in many federal lawsuits, matters are not disposed of that quickly. And so I think that, you know, bears a little bit of discussion as well.
Yes, sir. Like you say, I mean, the case looks like it, according to the docket sheet, it was 6-1. It was filed. It was actually removed out of the state courts. And by the 12th, we have a dismissal, which usually, in most cases, motions take 20 days. Each side is given 20 days to respond, and then you get another chance to amend the pleading. And because there's a lot of pressure sometimes on a plaintiff's counsel, you're acting in emergencies to help your client. So this dismissal, and then I think it was even on a Sunday or a Saturday that this decision came out, which is, this is a first for me. I've never heard of such a quick and speedy dismissal. Sister Barbara, I wanted to bring you in because I know that your experience in these courts, you've seen so much, my dear sister. And so what comments, if any, do you have on the opinion that has been issued on this shot, as they call it, lawsuit here in Houston?
Well, this is the way they usually behave. They usually come up with some reason to do what it is they want to do. And they decided that they wanted to deny this. And they came up with this idea that saying that, you know, it's a private agency, doesn't have to follow those laws, that the employees have the option of, if they don't want to do it, they can quit and get and go
right.
Work somewhere else.
Yes, ma'am.
So,
isn't that something?
Mm. But I was thinking about it after. This case, maybe they can take it up to the Supreme Court in Washington.
Yes, ma'am.
On
yes,
appeal.
Ma'am. You're right.
They might. might be available.
Yes, ma'am. Well, according to the lawyers, they did announce that they plan to appeal and to the Fifth Circuit and all the way up to the Supreme Court is what I hope to see, because as we know, we oftentimes have to appeal cases being dismissed or bad opinions, bad law being rendered by these judges is very much the norm. And so appealing a case, because, again, we're talking about discretion, so that discretion is what gives a black defendant a heavy sentence and allows the judge to give a white defendant a lesser sentence. We see that all the time. And so we want to make sure that we're understanding these terms. So let's go on to the next question. I know with you, Brother Arif, last week you called in when we were talking about this topic of the lawsuits and the call to action. And we know that there are religious exemptions. There are health exemptions that people may file to not be made to take these vaccines on jobs and other places, schools. And you made a very interesting comment when it came to the religious exemption, because you talked about how our God-given right to live is at the root of the exemption. Could you repeat that for our audience and, you know, give us some further understanding, because I think that's so very important.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. What we're seeing is a trend, again, by the enemy in terms of the wicked use of law. I want to point something out, Dust. This is really ironic. I was saying this today in an interview that I was doing, that the federal government fully acknowledges and knows that based upon the emergency use authorization and the law governing it in the U.S. Code, that they are not able to mandate anyone to take the vaccine. So the federal government has said they won't mandate it. Moreover, I read something that the federal government put out for federal employees, actually saying that although we would encourage everyone to take a vaccine, we're not going to mandate you to have to take a vaccine, and no employer should force you to try to take one at the federal level. And in addition to that, they can't even ask you if you have taken the vaccine. Mm. Now, that's interesting that the federal government has put that out in writing and then turned around and said at the same time, but we're not going to stop anyone else, meaning businesses or entities who may wish to, in words, do what we are not doing. So the government is trying to get both bites of the apple, knowing that they can't do it, but then also trying to give private enterprises and other entities that you'll see popping up with hospitals and schools and other facilities who are private that are trying to impose this, which is what the judge's decision was. He took a very strong position that this had nothing to do private employees, nothing. And he actually, in my opinion, as I read the complaint, and I hope the plaintiff's attorney take a good look at this. When I read the complaint, it seemed like the focus throughout the complaint was tied into employer employee and at will. And so the judge used that to get rid of the case when the issues are far bigger than that. But be that as it may, the religious exemption, what they're doing now around the country, whether it's colleges or legislatures, when they now have these forms asking you for religious exemption, they're asking you to say, what is the religious exemption? Do you see? They're asking you now to have to explain your religious beliefs. And when I spoke last week about Muhammad Ali, on the back page, we are conscientious objectors because we believe that we are righteous Muslims and we don't take part in wars that take the lives of humans. But we had to fight that all the way up to the Supreme Court. But now they're being deceitful by asking you to say, what is that belief? And so that's where I, by the grace of Allah, who shared the thought with me to say, my religious belief is to live. And my religious belief is to obey God and his commandment and his statutes, because in only being obedient, be obedient to Allah, can I have life. And God commanded us not to take this vaccine. It is my right to preserve my life. So because it is my right to preserve my life, and there's ample evidence that these vaccines can kill you. And so I raised the question, what person going to get a prescription filled, and it says one of the side effects of taking this medicine is death? Well, would you just take that, knowing that a major side effect could be death? If you're intelligent, you would say, well, this one I cannot take. I mean, it's a little different to get a little nausea or to be a little lethargic or, you know, whatever these other, maybe a little dizziness. That's bad enough. But to say death is a potential side effect? So, no, my religion is to live. My religion is to preserve my life. God is the giver of life. He gives life and causes death. And since it's my religion to live, and it is my religion to preserve my life, then that is the religious basis upon which I will not take this vaccine, in addition to the fact that the one we believe in, who is God's representative and servant to us, communicated to us by God, the Lord of the world, that we should not take it. So we are commanded to obey Allah and his messenger, and we are commanded that to obey the messenger is to obey Allah. And Allah commands us and calls us to that which gives life. Those are my religious convictions as to why I will not take this vaccine.
That's right. Yes, sir. No, that's beautiful. And it really, I wanted to interject that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, one of the articles that was in the final call last week, it was entitled Build Our Own Society. And so it's things like this that we see. These things, these type of actions, these type of wicked laws, they're putting us into the mindset of building our own employment, building our own jobs, building our own economy. Because I think Brother Arif, and I know it was Sister Barbara who brought up the private employer's right and how this particular opinion, to me it seems to shift the focus to this private employer so they can, you know, hide behind, whereas I feel like government should, you know, regulate and protect the citizenry, because we know from law school, remember those cases where factories used to burn down and kill many people? This is during the Industrial Revolution, you know, what is it called? The industrial phase of our country, where everything was in the building phase, and so factories were very faulty, and children were working in factories, and fires could occur and, you know, have devastating effect, which caused this country, this government had to come up with ways to protect the workers. So to allow employers to put profit over the health and safety of workers, I just think is egregious. And so I wanted to know, does anyone else have any concerns, and does anyone see this issue as well? Because, Brother Thiel, I'll ask you, because I know here in Texas, now this is a right-to-work state, but this attorney in this lawsuit, he, Mr. Woodle, or Woodful, I think is his name, he you know, drafted his argument that it's illegal to force someone to do something that is against federal mandates, because you have the right to refuse to take the vaccine because it is experimental, and it says it on the vaccine itself or on the shot or the injection. So how do we see employers' rights being able to be put over, you know, human concerns. And I hope a lot of employees will file lawsuits if people try to force them, such as this plaintiff did. But what, Brother Theo, could I'd ask you to give any comments that you may have on that subject?
Well, you know, what I often say is, you know, in any lawsuit, we have to be on the right road. You know, as I give an example, you know, the ultimate goal, let's say as an example, as some of us live here in Houston, the ultimate goal, let's say if we want to go to New York. Well, that's our goal, to get to New York, let's say, I'm using this as an analogy. But the point is, we have to be on the right road, you know, to make sure that, you know, we get the goal is to get to New York, but the method by which we get to that goal, you know, that's what I'm making the analogy. We have to be on the right road. And so, you know, as Brother Michael, as we were fortunate to listen to the program last week, you know, as Brother Michael pointed out, you know, you have these exemptions. Well, you have to work within, you know, those confines to see how we can craft these arguments so that, you know, to be on the correct road, if you will. And so to challenge the, you know, at-will employment, you know, may or may not have been the correct road to be on, but I think our challenge as attorneys, and even, you know, persons who might be listening, prospective employees who might be listening that, you know, want to challenge this or any other kind of law, we have to be, you know, cognizant and know that we have to be on the right road to make sure that our, you know, arguments are heard and plausible. You know, as we, I think, you know, some colleagues and I had talked about this the other day, that, you know, we have to be creative. You know, I think back, you know, when we had our civil rights attorneys back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, coming up with creative ideas, you know, to try to challenge these things, you know, these laws that were on the books, you know, in different ways. And so that, I think, is the challenge that that we have before us, to come up with all of these different ways. So we know, you know, that this might, you know, be a roadblock, if you will, but it doesn't mean that we cannot overcome, because, again, our challenge is to come up with, you know, different arguments that will get us to the ultimate goal.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And you're right, because the law is fluid, because as we go back to Chief Taney, who wrote the opinion in Dred Scott, and this is to say that we have to challenge these unjust laws, and maybe the, you know, the reaction that we get from judges who want to deny us our human rights, deny us due process, but we have to stand up and challenge them, because as Chief Justice Taney said in the Dred Scott decision, if the Founding Fathers intended to include black people in their declaration, and he's talking about black people being citizens, whether or not we were citizens, he said that the Founding Fathers intended to do that while personally enslaving them. He, you know, he wrote all around it. He said that would mean that they were hypocrites. And so, you know, he said them being such great men, he knew that black people who were enslaved were never part of the people of the U.S. and could never be citizens. You know, so they go on, and you find this in many of these old legal decisions where their interpretations are just wrong. You know, we would have not been able to get off the back of the bus, I guess, or some of these other seminal cases. So I agree with you, Brother Athiel, that we do have to be creative and, you know, stay the course, because I know, Sister Barbara, you fought cases that may not have been the popular opinion at the time, but then as time goes on, the truth comes out, and we see people vindicated for, you know, positions that were attacked years before. So this is why I think this case being one of the first I've seen here in Houston is so important, this case challenging. Sister Barbara, did you want to actually weigh in any more on this, on what you've talked about, private employers or anything we've said?
No. I think you guys have covered it very well.
Thank you so much, ma'am. This case is right on time. Yes, ma'am. Because I just want to just bring up real quick, you know, giving private sector influence, that's like when the Klan were able to put on their white robes and execute black people, that would circumvent the need for them to go through the court process. And then they could just throw their hands up and say, well, the Klan did it, you know, we, but you really, that was you with that white robe on. You know, so private, we're seeing this private sector issue come up. And I wanted to ask also, have we seen opinions rendered that are, you know, just plainly wrong, that give impressions of just decision making? I mean, we see the racial profiling, we see the disparate sentencing, we've seen so much. And you all, Brother Arif, Sister Barbara, Brother Theo, we've been on the front lines. As black attorneys, we have to be creative. So have we seen opinions rendered that are plainly wrong, and we know that there is a wicked use of the law where black people
are
victims and targeted? Yes, sir.
Yeah.
What'd you say, most of them
concerning us. There's too many to recount right now.
Mm-hmm.
But you started off with Justice Taney and Dred Scott.
Okay.
We could go on and on and on and on about the laws that are continually are violated. I mean, we can look at the laws that came as a result of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. There had to be laws that were supposed to be passed to stop from discrimination, but it didn't, and then you have to go fight more laws. Listen, segregation was a law. It was wicked. The slave codes was law. They were wicked. I mean, how far do we want to go, all the way down to this so-called qualified immunity for police officers who use it to justify killing us.
Right.
So there are so many, but I do want to say this, Pamela, about real quick about this private issue with employer. You know, when you're dealing with the law is built around a set of precepts and principles that order and guide. And the question that would have to be asked is, where does the law end on this? Because it seems like the door is swung wide open for darn near anybody to make a law if they want to concerning this a COVID vaccine and their right to try to force you and to intimidate you and to coerce you and to pressure you and to threaten you to take the vaccine. And that's why the Holy Quran verse, chapter 2, verse 155 says, and Allah will try you with something of fear and loss of property and fruits and lives and give good news to the patient. This is the enemy. He's pulling out all the stops to pressure us into capitulating. And now they're allowing all the way down to private individuals. Keep in mind, when you say private employer, who are you talking about? You're talking about a person. You're not just talking.
Right.
The hospital is run by a person. You understand?
Right.
The complaint quotes the CEO. That's a person, an individual. And laws don't just pop up, except the law of God. He, Allah, creates law from nature itself, starting with his creation. So there are immutable laws, but then there are man-made laws, which is what we're talking about. And the fact is, none of these laws exist outside of the agency of a man or woman who makes the law. So now they're allowing individuals, whatever they're hiding behind, if it's the hospital or the university, it's individuals who are making the law affecting the lives of other individuals. What happened to the Constitution of the United States? What happened to the First Amendment? What happened to the Fourth Amendment? Unreasonable searches and seizures. I know they about that in the criminal context, but listen, is what the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said. When they get to the point where they're now saying they're just going to bring the army and snatch you and force you to be injected, we're at total war now. So this is what I'm saying. Where then does the law start and end now? Because it seems like anybody is being allowed to make their own law. So that means you're now going to start to move into anarchy. Where anybody darn near can make a law.
Right.
That's what this crazy decision will lead others to think, that it's okay for me now to make my law.
Right.
And I mean, with what's going on with the police, we have a lot of examples of laws being made up to cover wrongdoing. I mean, the police will shoot somebody and say, "Oh, I thought he was pointing the gun at me. I thought he was going to shoot me." You know, they just come up with stuff.
Justify.
And
they
don't get punished because they're believing what the police said. That's why now that we're having people taking pictures with their phones and everything, that's helping us a little bit to, you know, catch these people
beautiful.
In their lives.
Yes, ma'am, that's beautiful. And as you said, the vaccine safety or efficacy was not even considered in adjudicating this issue. This is what's written in the opinion. So right now, I'm going to go to the phone. We do have some callers who would like to add to the conversation. And so I want to bring on Brother Warren. Brother Warren, your mic is open, Brother Warren. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for calling.
Walaikum salam. Greetings to everyone.
Walaikum salam,
yes, sir.
So I just wanted to comment briefly on this at-will employment. I really had anticipated that the decision would turn on that issue of Texas being a right-to-work state. And for the listeners, need to be clear, when it says that term is misleading, because when it says a right-to-work state, it really means you have no right to work.
Right.
Because an employer can terminate you for good cause, bad cause, or no cause, as long as they don't violate one of the protected classes such as race, gender, and religion. So,
good point.
I agree with Brother T and Brother R and Sister Barb as well. That one must be very careful how your case is pled and how you craft your pleading, because sometimes you can create a trap for yourself. I think with this being crafted in terms of employment, it automatically gave the judge a go-to to say, well, in Texas, this is not based on race, it's not based on sex, it's not based on religion. So this private entity has a right to determine if they want people to take it or not, or they can fire you. That could be, the cause could be bad cause, they could have good cause, or no cause at all. Under the right to work laws of at-will employment, they are at liberty to do that. So that really, I think, is where this decision turns.
Right. Yes, sir. Good point, Brother Warren.
But Sister Pamela?
Yes, sir.
Sister Pamela, I want to say thank you, Brother Warren, and I do want to say this to the listeners, too. Just to keep in mind, because the enemy is trying to take this one case in the Fifth Circuit in a single district court that has many, many other courts within that district, as other states do, because every state has circuit court systems. This is one decision from the lowest court in the federal system,
right.
A court. And so the enemy, using the media, as I've read the media, are trying to suggest to you that somehow this decision is the law across the United States, and that it's sending a signal to other, quote, employers that they have the right to do this. And though it's another issue that we haven't addressed yet, I think it's very dangerous for people to tie vaccine mandates to the fact that the FDA may, and I say may guardedly, I'm sure that they desire to, grant a full biologic license to both Moderna and Pfizer. And so many are arguing that the EUA doesn't permit you to have to be mandated to take the vaccine. But the converse of that is to make you think that once the Federal Drug Administration were to issue a permanent license, that automatically also then means you can mandate the vaccine. And that is also legally untrue.
Mm-hmm.
Just
yes,
because
sir.
The FDA, it's like the FDA has several thousands of medicines that they've issued licenses to. It does not, as we say in the law, ipso facto meaning it doesn't automatically mean that because of that, this drug is mandated for you to take. Every drug,
yes,
there's a choice involved. So I want to say that too for the audience. So just to keep in mind, the decision is one decision from the lowest level court in the federal system in a circuit. Don't listen to the media's lie that this is a decision that somehow has established a constitutional right for an employer to force you to take a vaccine. That is a lie, and it's a wicked interpretation. And even if the FDA were to actually issue a license for Moderna or Pfizer, it still doesn't mean it mandates you to take that vaccine. I want to be clear about that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you, Brother Arv. I'm going to take a call. We have another call. A brother, Deshaun. Brother Deshaun, your mic is open, sir.
Yes, this is Brother Deshaun from Mach 55. I'm an attorney down here in Memphis, and I've been practicing for about 20 years. Alaikum salam, sister, and to all the guests. I can't touch what Brother Arif said. I think he addressed all of that. I was calling in because you were asking about basically people making unjust decisions in terms of the law. And the majority of my practice nowadays is family law. And so I deal a lot with child abuse, neglect, and delinquency. And
oh,
so
beautiful.
A large chunk of my practice is dealing with that school to prison pipeline that you were talking about. And I can tell you that, you know, generally, if I have a blonde client, my work is more or less done for me in terms of the fight to get them, keep them from having to deal with more than they should because they've been overcharged or whatever. I kind of know the direction that the results are going to be, but it's when I have, you know, a client that looks like myself that I have to go all out and I have to take steps that normally you wouldn't even take in these types of cases, you know, subpoenaing people and, you know, getting psychological records and so forth, because I let's put it this way. I recently had a case in a juvenile court where a judge was referring to my client as a man, but this is a juvenile, it's a 16-year-old. Everybody else who comes through there is a child. But when the judge starts referring to my client as a man, then I'm starting off at a disadvantage because you don't see them as a child who can be rehabilitated. We haven't even established that he did anything wrong, but you're talking to him as though he's able to, you know, take care of himself.
That's right.
And this is the environment that I deal with on a consistent basis. And so when you talk about, you know, the law being, when you talk about discretion being used in that way, when you have people who see us like that, who see our children as being adults, then the discretion is obviously going to go in the other direction. And so that's part of what I deal with. But in terms of the decision that you guys were talking about, the Houston decision, my question would be, I understand that the route that the attorney took is probably not the route that any of us would have taken with this. My question is, a hospital receives funds from the federal government and is heavily, heavily regulated by the federal government. So in terms of something like the vaccine, why would it all of a sudden be treated as a solely private institution when it's so heavily public?
You know, brother, can you hear me, Sister Pamela?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Right ahead,
you know, and that was a good that actually I picked up as well, because in order to tie in, you know, it to sort of make it public, as you were just, you know, suggesting, I would have, and I'm not criticizing, because, you know, I may have missed it also, but in hindsight, I may have, you know, tied in and put in the pleading that, as you just said, that they're regulated, they're recipient of federal funds kind of way. That's how you get them in. You know, that's how, you know, you can then begin to apply, you know, the code of federal regulations, a certain aspect of it. So now I you know, as I was reading the defendant's motion to dismiss, they talked about that there was no standing. You know, that the plaintiffs did not have standing in these different things, and that the hospital was private. Well, in order to get around that, you bring that in and you make that allegation. And so it's also, you know, when you know, if you were suing, let's say, a private university, you know, you bring in your pleadings that they are a recipient of federal funds. That gets you into federal court. That gets you then on that, you know, put you on the road to, you know, getting some, you know, redress and adjudication. And this is what I was talking about a little bit earlier, that we have to be, you know, creative in our pleadings, because, you know, just as we were talking about earlier, you know, and people disagree with what I say sometimes, but, you know, when Mother Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to go to the back of the bus, well, that was the law. So in that regard, yes, she violated the law, but was that law just? And then that's when the creative minds had come in to challenge justness of that law, similar to the Dred Scott decision. You know, at the time, as we, you know, that's one of my favorite quotes, you know, Justice Taney and all of that stuff, that the mindset was already there for that law. But the creative, you know, ways to get around it, to argue it differently, as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has told us on several cases, you know, hey, what is God's law? And that's what we have to, that, in my opinion, is the biggest challenge that we have. Of conscious attorneys, we have to come up with those creative ways to get around and beat them with their own law. As Denzel Washington said in Training Day, this isn't checkers, this is chess. We can never.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I wanted to say this about it. Keep in mind, going back to what you're saying, Brother Thiel, and thank our dear brother attorney from Memphis, there's a reason why the defendant in this case had the case moved to federal court. And he was clearly concerned about the case being in state court in Texas, because state court has a particular view that was not in favor of the hospital, Methodist. And our brother attorney, Michael Muhammad, and I don't know if he was going to be on tonight or the comment, but he and I had a great discussion, and he had sent me something from Governor Abbott, Greg Abbott, who had issued an executive order, and it says, relating to COVID-19 vaccines and the protection of Texans' private health information. And essentially what he said was, no employer can force you to take a vaccine. They can't even ask you about taking a vaccine. and any entity in the state that receives funds can't do it either. So I think that the lawyers for the hospital knew that they had a problem if this case stayed in state court under state law. And so they had it immediately removed to the federal because they saw that they could have a problem in the state. And I think that in looking at, like we were saying, commenting on the pleadings, how you frame your issue not only has relevance to how a decision is rendered, but it also indicates what your appeal is going to look like too, because appeals generally are based upon filing errors of law against the judge. What errors did he make? And
yes,
it appeared from my plain reading that in Texas, the law seemed to be more favorable to the plaintiffs here than the federal. So that's why Methodist quickly got it moved to federal. And so that's another point, because as we know as lawyers in pleading, you could have a federal question or issue dealing with the federal law, but you can also have an issue in the federal court about a state law, and they call it ancillary law, but then the court has to render a judgment based upon the law of that state. So there are many different ways of looking at this, but I believe that the defendants knew that the state law in Texas was not favorable to them as quote-unquote employers based upon the governor's executive order that he passed in April 5th, 2021. And Brother Michael also brought up an issue of Title VII discrimination that was not pled. But again, we're not saying this as a critique of the attorneys who were involved in this. They did what they could do, but they did say they were not finished. They were going to continue. It's my understanding, according to Brother Michael, that they also plan on going back into state court. So these are some other aspects to look at in terms of this case. So it's not over by a long shot. So everybody, don't get excited. The fight continues.
Yes, sir. And for our listeners, because I'm getting ready to bring on Brother Michael, he's on the line. But I do want to say, see, this is why sometimes I say law is like a spectator sport, like this is some kind of boxing ring. And it's very tragic because these are people's lives at stake. One thing the judge did do, which I would definitely argue on appeal is an error, is that he refused to listen to the medical expert that the plaintiff supplied, who was able to talk about the dangers and talk about the safety. And that was just totally dismissed, saying that, oh, it just wasn't proper form or something. So, you know, this is what we see. These are people's lives that we must protect our own lives. So let me bring on Brother Michael. I'm going to open up his mic. Brilliant brother. Brother Michael, are you on the line? Is your mic open? Okay, I see it now. Yes, sir. Brother Michael, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Pamela. And Brother
what?
Art,
I said all
Brother
of that
Phil.
Now, Brother Michael is on the line.
Sister Barbara, and all of your listening audience. And I'm just having a, I'm just, you know, all over myself sitting here listening to the conversation tonight. I just want to make a couple of statements, Sister Pamela. One, his refusal to listen to the medical evidence is consistent with the Supreme Court opinion from the 1900s. So he's following in his father's footsteps, where they said that it didn't matter that there was alternative science or alternative opinion. All that matters is that the medical authority in that area directed that there be a smallpox vaccine. So he's following in the footsteps of his father. The complaint, the original complaint, I haven't had an opportunity to read the amended complaint that they filed in federal court, but their original petition in state court, they did explicitly state within their factual allegations that their request for religious exemptions and exemptions based on their medical condition were arbitrarily denied. Now, what's interesting about that is we know that those are the exceptions, the recognized exception to the vaccine requirement, and Methodists themselves, according to what I have read, also recognize those two exceptions. It may be a good thing that he wasn't able to get into that because it leaves it for another day. But I would be interested in knowing what was the basis of their religious request and their medical request, and I would be interested in knowing what was the reason for denying those requests. The other thing that I think is important is that when you're talking about a hospital, and this goes to what Brother Iris was saying, vaccines within the context of a medical facility and requiring them is viewed more leniently in that context. So when we talk about other employers, say if you're a truck driver or if you're a welder and you're somewhere where you're not ever near other people, would the requirement be reasonable? So those are some things we have to take into account as we look at the types of employers and what happens in the context of the different types of employment. So for a truck driver, it may be entirely unreasonable to attempt to mandate a vaccine and may be looked at differently than a person working in a hospital environment. And finally, I just want to say that the receipt of federal money is always conditioned on something. And whether they are recipients of federal funding or not, I don't know. But the federal government always has conditions associated with providing money to any entity. Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting to find out whether or not they are, what the conditions are as relates to the hospital and whether they include pushing the vaccine. But anyway, this case is if you have a limited set of facts, you have a limited set of circumstances. You have people who were at-will employees who didn't plead anything outside of the context of, that would get them outside of the realm of being employees at will. So I would say we still haven't had a real look at the issue where the pleadings actually the pleadings are such that the court is forced to address the question in a more thorough way, because you can't just say, you know, they're at will, and that pretty much ends the analysis. So thank you for allowing me to comment, and it's good to hear my brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Oh, yes, sir. Thank you for your comments. Did anyone have something they wanted to say? Go ahead, Sister Barbara. Yes, ma'am.
I'm willing to bet that this case is going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I believe
well,
it.
I would say this.
I don't know.
Michael, go ahead.
Yes, and I mean, and plaintiff's counsel has indicated that they will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But I don't necessarily know if this is the best case for that. One, the way it was pled, the basis for what the lower court or its rationale for doing what it did. You know, when Thurgood Marshall, under the direction of Charles Hamilton Houston, was going around basically recruiting plaintiffs, and they were filing cases to eventually find one that they could get to the Supreme Court that would be winnable in an effort to try to help our people. Some facts in cases are better than others. And, you know, I don't know that this is the best case for us or anybody who thinks that people should have the option of taking the vaccine to end up in the Supreme Court.
Well, clearly, on Brother Michael's point. I'm sorry, Brother Michael. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Brother.
Agreeing with you that one of the clear issues in this case, it was so much that the judge decided he was not going to consider. And he considered only the point that he thought was relevant to him, which had to do with employee-employer contact. The question is whether or not error can be sustained to give an appeal on the grounds that there were critical errors in the consideration of the evidence that was being presented. Sister Pamela mentioned it earlier concerning Dr. McCullough's affidavit. He just like threw that to the side like it didn't matter. And then, of course, you had the law itself that he disregarded, and so many areas that he chose to not even address. The question is, how can you frame an argument on appeal that all of these different points was reversible errors as a matter of law? That's going to be
sir.
The challenge. And that's always tough on appeal. But if they're going to go back, if they can go, since it was removed from state court, because they had this federal question in them, I don't know what they're thinking about in state court, but it still seems to me, based upon the position of the state of Texas, that it may be a winnable situation in state court, which could technically present a conflict between the federal and the state court, which gives you a direct writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court, because the same jurisdiction of the federal level versus the state, they're in conflict with each other. So that might get you in before the Supreme Court. But always keep in mind with the Supreme Court, there's no appeal of right to the Supreme Court. You
okay.
have to file a writ of certiorari. They decide if they're going to hear it or not. You don't have no automatic right to appeal to the Supreme Court except in certain very limited circumstances that they define. So just keep that in mind as well. And there are 8,000-9,000 cases a year filed, and only a few hundred get taken up. So all of that are factors to be considered.
Yes, sir. And you know, Brother Arif, I totally agree with you all. I guess Brother Deshaun, he really did affect me with his call, because, as you all know, I am also an advocate for children. And the due process violations that go on with the removal of black children and black families. So from that aspect, you know, we're looking at some real fundamental rights that are being stripped by these courts. An example is I had a case that got returned on appeal because they didn't feel like this black mother even had the right to a lawyer in her hearing. So, you know, I just knew I had a home run on that, right, because I wrote that she didn't have a lawyer, she's entitled to a lawyer. Everybody's entitled to a lawyer when they're faced with a proceeding.
Right.
And so, you know, of course, even though the state fought it, they had all kind of, it was her fault. But the Court of Appeals did rule in my favor because you're entitled to certain rights. And I think at the root of this case, I'm very concerned with the what looks to me like no due process, because I've never seen a case that was decided in 12 days. You know, 12-B6 motion, the federal court, the federal rules of procedure, because we have rules, y'all. I'm talking about the people who are listening, to us talk about this legal stuff. But we have like a playbook. So if I file a motion, then I'm supposed to get 20 days to respond. And then I'm also supposed to get the ability to correct my pleading if maybe it's a problem, because I'm representing rights. So we got to look at the fact that this legal wrangling, this game playing, and I'll just finally say, we know sometimes even with people on death row, you know, the courts will hide behind the fact that you supposedly don't have any rights,
even though this person might be innocent. They're, you know, they're executing innocent people saying, well, you missed the deadline for filing. And, you know, so this is just an unjust and wicked system. And this is what we're talking about. So I want to bring on Sister Donna Muhammad, who has a something that she'd like to say. Sister Donna, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Sister Pani Pamela, and to the esteemed panel this evening, this is brief. I just want to say thank you, because as a non-legal person, I am being so empowered and educated through this program. And even though I know that I am resolved in not taking the vaccination, I feel like tonight I was armed with even more information when I talk to people and when I present reasons as to why, especially Brother Arf, as you brought, Brother Attorney Arf, as you brought forth the deeper meaning of our religion in the right to life. That was so profound to me, the further explanation of it. So I just wanted to thank you all for this wonderful program. I look forward to more episodes, because it's just like it says at the tagline, empowering the people. I really, truly feel empowered, and I learned so much more tonight, all the way down to what you just said in regards to the Supreme Court, them choosing whether they're going to hear an appeal. So I thank you all, and I look forward to more and more engagement on these topics.
All praise is due to Allah.
Sister Pamela, you know, what is interesting, if I may, you know, and I don't, again, and I'm just letting everybody know, I don't know what the wranglings were, but the plaintiffs filed their amended complaint on June 10th. On June 11th, the defendants filed the motion to dismiss plaintiff's first amended complaint. And the very next day, June 12th, was the ruling.
Exactly.
And this
that's incredible. That's incredible.
Right.
Exactly.
Now, granted, just
that
for
doesn't
the listening audience, you know, when
that
somebody
doesn't
files
exactly.
Their motion, you know, you have 20 days, and so the defendant, you know, you don't have to take the entire day, but there's something happened that I'm just not understanding. How you can file the amended complaint on the, as I said, on the 10th, I beg your pardon, on the 11th, on the 10th, the defendant's motion to dismiss plaintiff's first amended complaint the very next day, and then the ruling on the 12th. Something happened that, and so I even think that might even be, you know, who knows, but it might even be an appealable issue. I might imagine. I'm certainly not sure, not knowing, you know, all of the wranglings that had gone on. But as you said, Sister Pamela, there was something interesting with respect to that.
Yes, sir. Well, yes, sir, I agree. And so we are down to our last, I believe it is, 5 minutes. And so this has really gone by fast. And I wanted to just ask in closing, so we're counselors, we're attorneys, but we're also counselors. So what solutions, if any, do we want to leave our audience with tonight? I know I, for one, I understand, you know, people's concerns, employment, but I do think it's very important that we see that the safety and efficacy of whether or not these vaccines are safe was not on the table in this ruling. It was not considered as being, you know, relevant. It was kind of like, well, if the people don't want to take it, they just don't have a job. And so, therefore, to me, I know I, you know, say we have to protect our own lives, and we do have the right to freedom, justice, and equality and liberty interests against, you know, doing something that may or may not be my religion, as well as something I don't think is ethically, morally safe for me. you know, so this, we're seeing people, the young people, you know, who are now coming up with the inflammation in their hearts. We saw a 19-year-old college black girl who died suddenly today, and I won't say today,
that's
but
right.
in the last several days. Beautiful young lady who took it, and you know the comments are being made that these are things that we did not foresee, perhaps. And so I think we have time for one more caller. I believe we have a sister. Is that Sister Ava? Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Yes.
Wow. Welcome.
I open your mic. I think you have a question. I'm making sure. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I had a comment.
A comment, yes, ma'am.
Just wanted to congratulate you and also say how much I am really being edified and by this discussion. And I do realize that, as Allah says, they plan and He plans, and Allah is the best of planners. You know, we've gone through phases with this pandemic, and I put that word in quotes, with initially the shock to the American people of the news of the pandemic, and then coping with this outbreak, coping with the news of the deaths and the overwhelming number of people pouring into hospitals, experiencing the loss of someone, then coping with the response of the government with the lockdowns, with the mask, with the social distancing, with the shutting down of life, the schools, the jobs, everything gone in a heartbeat, no notice, and then dealing with the vaccines. From a health standpoint, and Minister Farrakhan's warning before the vaccines were deployed that whatever they came with for COVID-19, it would be death and to stay away from it. And now we're moving into the critical phase that all of you are so important, and that's why I know this program will grow by leaps and bounds because our people need it. And that is these legal mandates and the ultimate crushing of our freedom, our personal liberties, and wiping out permanently any chance of freedom, justice, and equality for us as black people, first and foremost. But then this is spreading to humanity in general. And it's what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, Allah will make you separate. But I thank you all. This has been awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. And I wanted to take this time to announce and make sure that you tune in on Thursday to Ask Dr. Ava, which is the show on the Elevated Places Network featuring our sister, Dr. Ava Muhammad, who is a national spokesperson for the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And I would like to thank you all on the panel for attending and participating in this panel, Brother Attorney Abdul Arif Muhammad, Brother Athil Muhammad, Sister Barbara Muhammad, thank you all so very much for taking out your time to share with us. I would also like to thank the Elevated Places team. That is Sister Donna Muhammad, Brother Terrence Muhammad, who has helped us with promotions. He's so awesome. And I do really want to thank the listeners for listening to A Time for Justice. To hear previous shows, you can log into blogtalkradio.com, and this would be with the Elevated Places Network. And so tune in next week. We have some excellent lawyers. We have Sister Sadia Muhammad, Sister Kiana Muhammad, and Brother Jack Muhammad scheduled to attend, and they will be talking about the juvenile issues, the prison pipeline, and other ways that the law is used to target and harm our youth and our families. So thank you, and listen next week on Tuesday. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Wa alaikum salam.
Wa alaikum salam.